Hello and welcome to Conversations with the Voice of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's guest is Sarah Hayter, the founder and operator of Ex-Muslims of North America. You can find out more about Ex-Muslims of North America at exmuslims.org. It is basically a resource for individuals who are retiring from their faith in Islam, and it's a place for resources and community, and also a lot of information about that particular subset of humanity. Sarah moved to America from Pakistan when she was 8 years old, so she has a lot of cultural and other ties to her home country, and she decided at some point that Islam was not for her, and she's been very vocal about speaking out about the issues that she has with that faith and with certain cultural behaviors and attitudes within Islamic countries. She also highly prizes secular, liberal, Western society and is now watching with some surprise as an illiberal and yet still secular movement that we define as wokeness for the sake of this particular conversation is rising up. A sort of fundamentalism is rising up within America in so-called Western secular humanist liberal democracies. And she's very concerned about that. So that's kind of what we talk about. And I get her perspective on liberalism and illiberalism and the values that she prizes and that she doesn't want our society to lose touch of. Again, find more about Sarah Hayter at exmuslims.org or on Twitter at Sarah the Hayter, H-A-I-D-E-R. Without further ado, here's Sarah. Do you mind if I just start?
We can start whenever you want.
Okay, yeah. How's it going?
Going good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How's your ex-Muslims website going, that project that you're working on?
It's my organization. It's going pretty good. Obviously, COVID is hard. COVID is hard for, has been hard for everyone, all nonprofits. It's just been a kind of a unstable year. And when people are nervous, they don't want to give you money.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So from that perspective, it's sort of across all nonprofits, it's been kind of a tough year.
Yeah.
But we've been good otherwise. We've been producing good content. I'm excited to release this really unique survey coming out soon on ex-Muslims. It's a report. It's going to be part of our website. We're going to have articles and videos and all kinds of things associated with it. So I'm excited for that to come out soon.
And you said it was a survey?
A survey, yeah. One of our projects. It's been a survey we did of 470-something ex-Muslims, and it was a kind of a lengthy survey. People in our communities who've been assisting, they went ahead and filled out a survey with us. It contains all kinds of interesting information, background information about them, demographics, why they left, how they... what caused them to leave, or what are the, how they conceptualize, you know, these are the motivating factors that matter to me. And their experiences afterwards, what, you know, abuse, acceptance, whatever. And so that's coming out soon. I'm excited about it.
Are you willing to kind of share like some of the interesting data points or kind of like the, I don't know, personality, patterns that you've seen?
Sure, I'm happy to talk about that as... Yeah. Much as you want to talk about it.
Yeah. What's something that stuck out to you about that, or that surprised you, or I guess
Well, I mean, in many ways, we look like atheists in general, because it is atheists. Okay. It's, you know, so highly educated, highly, highly educated, even more highly educated than immigrants are in general. So it's a largely immigrant population, or first generation or second generation. Immigrants tend to be more educated than the average person. Our population is even more educated than the average immigrant. So we have a highly educated population. And then we ask them questions about, you know, what kind of household did they grow up in, whether it was strict or religious. And I was expecting, you know, I don't know, I was torn. I was thinking that we could either have a lot of people that come from religious households or very irreligious households where like doubt is something that can be openly fostered. And what I found that it was just kind of all over the place. Like there was a kind of a beautiful normal curve there. So that was interesting to me. We also asked them about their, I don't know, are you rolling now? Are we live? Or
yeah. We're going.
Okay. Sorry. We're on. We also asked them questions about how do their social views change after leaving religion? How do their political views change after leaving religion? And for the vast majority of them, they said that their views liberalized, which is what you would expect. Okay. So they became more liberal after leaving faith. And then we asked them about where their politics are now, where their social views are now, where they would place themselves on a progressive to conservative, like, what's it called?
Spectrum,
right. And the vast majority said that they lean progressive or were very progressive. We had some amount of centrists and almost no conservatives, which was interesting. And ex-Muslims in general are, the reason I asked that question is because I did strongly feel like this would be the finding. And I was very tired of ex-Muslims being portrayed again and again as conservatives or, you know, right-wing in some fundamental sense. And I think that has a lot to do with our current political moment. You can't even call it current, I guess, since it's been like this since perhaps Salman Rushdie. But it's this stereotype of what ex-Muslims are and what they believe and what kinds of values are motivated by. So I asked that question because I was hoping to draw some light and to have some data behind me as well, instead of just anecdotes. It was very interesting findings. We're going to be publishing a report soon. It's long. And then we're going to have some shorter bits that we're going to share as well in other formats that might be easier for people to digest.
Do you happen to have a control group specifically for highly educated Muslims that stay in the faith as opposed to leave?
We don't. But that would be interesting. It would be interesting to, I guess, find such a group and then ask them similar questions. But many of our questions were specific to the ex-Muslim experience. So there were a lot of questions about what was a factor that influenced their decision to leave. I asked questions like, were human rights a factor, and to what degree was it a factor? Was it a most important factor, or just something that was involved, or something that wasn't really a factor at all in your decision to leave the faith? Asked about whether there were contradictions within the scripture that was involved, whether it was an inability to reconcile what we knew about the natural world through science and what we were told about the natural world through religion, and to what degree was that a factor? So all of those questions are there. And they were very interesting. And I tried to find when I was creating the survey whether these questions were asked of atheists in general at any point. And I wasn't really able to find anything similar about, you know, non-believers, even as a much larger group. So this might be a unique survey in more than one respect.
Yeah. Is there, are you aware of a gray area? Is there like a middle step between being Muslim and being ex-Muslim? Is there like this agnostic kind of group or this kind of?
So there's the, I guess what you might call an identity, which is to say how you affiliate in a tribal sense. You know, what are the people you feel close to and you feel like are your people? And then where you are intellectually. And those are different questions, and people land in different places. And with ex-Muslims in particular, we're a tricky population because many of us are immigrants. So it's this, so American culture, Western culture is sort of an adopted culture. It's not, it might not be the culture we feel most familiar with, most comfortable in. And so there's this sense of alienation from like the broader culture. Too often, whole nationalities are completely conflated with religious belief. So if you are, as I am, a Pakistani, you are presumed to be religious within the Pakistani community. I mean, there's no difference between, you know, a Pakistani and a Muslim. It's the same thing. Like, if you are Pakistani, you are Muslim. the way Pakistan is organized often is related to religious events, right? Eid is like a common way that the community gets together. It's an occasion for the community to get together. But what do you do if you're not religious? Well, I mean, you go anyway, but you're at the mosque. Now you pray with everyone. Then you have, you know, food with everyone and celebrate with everyone after. So it's tricky for ex-Muslims in particular, in a way that I think Christians who leave the faith in a majority Christian society, I mean, they won't experience the same kind of pull, I guess, in the other direction in a tribal way. So there are a lot of ex-Muslims who still feel strong resonance with their cultural background, you know, whether that be Arab or Somali or whatever. They feel very close to the music, the art, the fashion, you know, the ways of speaking, the poetry. They feel very that this is their home and these are their people. And then when this ideological difference comes into play, there it causes quite a disturbance in like the psyche, right? For somebody that feels pulled in like two different directions in that way. I'm pretty lucky in that respect, in that I was raised here for most of my life. I wasn't born in the United States, but I was raised in the United States. So American culture is a culture that's familiar to me. I speak the language as if it was my native language. It is not my native language, but I understand it. I understand the culture. So the divide is not that, it's not that painful for me. But it is often the case for many ex-Muslims.
Yeah. Yeah. I can especially, that compounds with being a stranger in a strange land. And then that Islam being like one of the major tenets of you being plugged into a community. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm very curious about how, because within Western Christianity, we developed secularism. We have this kind of this chain of thought and discussion going back for a few centuries now, where we kind of made this secular bubble that's within Christendom. It has this weird kind of, rebel against the power structure, but it's still encased within Christendom. Is there something like that within Islamic cultures, Islamic countries, where there's a kind of a secular place? Does Islam have room for something that is not non-believer, anti-belief, but just a belief, agnostic kind of discourse?
So that's, you know, that's kind of an open question. And I think that the answer to that is something that's going to be self-evident in the coming decades. Not immediately, but probably soon, and maybe sooner than some people anticipate. Historically, it is not the same. And I think that you know, the tendency is to say that all religions are the same, but they're not the same. And the fundamentals of religions are different, but also the histories of religions are different. So Islam behaves differently because Islam has a different history. And that history of interpretation, you know, of scholarly discussion, of legal discussion has been different because it was situated in a different place. They were dealing with different circumstances. You know, one of the things that I point to quite frequently, and really anyone points to it if they're familiar with the different faiths, is that Islam was very quickly the faith of those in power, right? Muhammad became a statesman, you know, very, very early on in his career, like within his life, right? So he was the political authority very quickly. And Islam remained the political authority for a long period of time, you know, within their domain, sometimes even ruling over Christians and Jews. And so that is reflected in the way that it understands itself and the way, you know, scholars have understood, like, what are the duties of Muslims and where the discussions lie. And, you know, from what I understand, for example, from Judaism, there's a line of thought and discussion that's been spanning forever of what are the duties of Jews as a religious people and citizens of a specific state, you know, and to talk about the way that those duties contradict, perhaps, or don't contradict, and where should a pious Jewish person land. And that's there's been an active discussion there, a very important discussion there. It's not the same for Muslims. So some of these questions, some of these discussions in the religion are very new. So we'll see where they go.
Yeah, and the same with liberalism. You brought up, and there's something in the survey where you're saying that the data shows that there's this adoption of liberal values. Are those liberal values, from what I hear, from what you're saying, and so I need you to specify, but those kind of are kind of part of the Western tradition. Those kind of grew out of all these dialogues, specifically in Europe. That's what's called liberalism. So I just wonder, is a version of liberalism capable of growing out from within is Islam and the Muslim community? And what are your thoughts about how it's going to be adopted into that? And, finding those contours in the work that you're doing.
Right. And it's just to clarify one thing, the question we asked was progressive or conservative, which is different.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think you know that it is.
I'm a little familiar with that distinction.
Right. So it's progressives. But I would imagine that many of them are liberals also.
Why did you ask that then?
Why didn't I ask liberal?
I
wanted to know political right, political left. That's what I wanted to know in the United States sense.
Okay.
And, you know, we can have a discussion about where the word liberal lands there. And those distinctions, but most people aren't aware. And when you are crafting a survey, you have to phrase things in a way most people will understand.
So, anyway,
that's the question we asked, but I would imagine many of them are liberals also. And at the very least, in that general way that many people in the West do, have adopted liberal values, enlightenment values. I think that that's, I wish I had an answer for you, but I've been very curious about whether these values can develop organically. I have a feeling that it wouldn't be organic, or it wouldn't manifest in the same way. And if we were to have something approaching liberal values, it would feel different. It would be different. It would emphasize different things. Certainly, secularism is not as easy to justify within Islam as it is in Christianity. But other things might be easier to justify. Other liberal, tenets might be easier. But secularism isn't, because a deep aspect of Islam is that the state is kind of or should be. The ruler being the caliph and living under an Islamic caliphate is something that Muslims should desire. And this is a public thing. And up until the 20th century, there was a caliphate. So it's that sort of thing will be difficult in Islam. And it's difficult to justify in Islam. Democracy, there's a lot of discussions that are had by scholars about these specific values and whether or not they can be adopted within Islamic context. Whether they can develop organically, the answer to that is probably no. And if they do, they would look very different. Whether they can be adopted, I don't know. I think that they can certainly be adopted by a loud and passionate minority within those communities or countries. In this case, because in my opinion, their liberal values are good values. They are, they are they allow us to live happier lives, to more to live more fulfilled lives. I think that to the extent that we can make them work with a population that is majority Muslim, and that is something that is desirable to do, even if it isn't organic, you know, in the way that we might, in the way that it might be with Christianity having developed slowly over the course of many centuries.
There was a interview that was, no, a speech that you gave where you, I'm going to quote you, we have plenty of evidence that a push for secularism or a presence within secular culture can change behavior and even the beliefs of Muslims, less extreme, more in line with liberal values. And the reason I reached out to you this time around is because you wrote on Twitter that you were going to say something about a certain issue, but then you're like, I will get canceled. It seems like you were pointing that there's another sort of illiberalism that's rising up within America around the trans issue, but it's also in other kind of progressive side of the conversation is kind of getting rather rigid in its adherence to certain articles of faith. And I'm just wondering, what are you, what is your perspective on dealing with a rather forceful set of belief, the belief system of Islam. I don't know to what extent it's inflexible, but it seems rather rigid in its adherence to a certain article of faith. And then going from that into a liberal society and then seeing within this other liberal society those currents kind of arising again, human drive to be right and then to enforce that correct behavior on other people. If you have any, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly, I mean, seeing, and I will refer to it as wokeism because I don't have any other, any better word to, you know, to refer to this one phenomena that we, I think we all see and we all know.
Yeah.
So for lack of a better word, that's what I'm going to refer to it as. It's changed my focus quite a bit, and it changed my approach to, I guess, religion in general. I mean, the obvious thing that anyone can tell you is that, you know, you can lose religion, but you don't necessarily lose dogma. There are certain ways of behaving that are human, and those are the ways, you know, those are the kind of human tendencies that religion feeds into and, you know, plugs into and harnesses in a way that, you know, other institutions have not been able to harness in the same kind of way. But seeing wokeism rise the way that it has and play out in a way that I'm very familiar with when it comes to religious communities, you know, and I can, there are times where it seems, where I have to sort of slap myself and say, this is, I'm actually in a secular society and I'm talking to people who are highly educated, who have grown up in the West. You know, it's unbelievable sometimes when I hear what sounds like dogma and ways of behaving. You know, they have different values and they have different goals, but their behavior, the methods that they use to achieve those ends, very much the same and very familiar to me as somebody that has been, you know, talking about religion and reforming religious communities for a very long time. And it's extremely disturbing, and dispiriting to some degree, because you think, okay, I'm going to, you move away from Muslim societies and here's this answer we have in the West, right? And there's this shining beacon liberalism that has thrived in the West and produced a society where people are so open and so free and have a level of equality and freedom that is unheard of and has been unheard of up until very, very, you know, recent past. And then to see from within, you know, that hope, that great hope, this illiberalism rise and capture the most educated people, the most free people, the most privileged, you know, people within that society. You know, from my perspective, it's, oh, so this is what we were working towards. This is what I would like for Muslim societies to become more like. But then here they are behaving in ways that feel very familiar in a negative sense. And you know, from my perspective, are threatening some of the very cherished liberties, freedoms, equalities that we do have here.
Mm-hmm. And so is your faith in this secular humanism shaken, or is there like a skepticism about there was something in there that gave rise to this? Or I could pull back a little bit. When did you first start seeing what we're going to call wokeness right now rise up? And do you see that its roots, did it kind of like triggers go off? Like there's some pattern here that I've seen before that I was trying to solve in my home community.
Yeah. So, well, let me answer actually the first question that you had, which is, did it shake my faith? It didn't really shake my faith in that this is still a place we want to come to. But it made me feel as if we have to work hard to keep it, and maybe harder than I thought. And that it is sort of work that has to be done in every generation. And to the extent that I think we're losing it here, we're losing it because there's a generation that does not know what it is like to live in any other society, you know, and I think they take the freedoms, the equalities, the prosperity that they have here for granted. They don't understand it as prosperity. They don't understand it as freedom. It's one of those things that until you know what it is like to live without it, you don't know that you have it. It's the fish water thing. So I'm thinking about ways that we can inculcate a sense of importance for these values within every generation, even generations that have grown up relatively privileged and have never lived without it. And now I'm thinking, and so my focus has shifted just a little bit. I can't say I've lost faith entirely, but I have started to feel as if that's not the end. You know, we can reach this wonderful place, this you know, liberal utopia, but then we have to keep working. And maybe it's not as firm a foundation.
Well, you don't like to work when things are handed to you. That's the problem. So it doesn't
you
become
don't know
a
what
habit.
You're working towards. You don't know. You know, and it's very frustrating to me also as, just to go off a little bit on a tangent here, but as an immigrant, you know, to hear people on, you know, on what is often the left disparage America, to claim mm-hmm. that we're, you know, not free here or we're, you know, oppressed in one way or another because of, you know, systems of injustice. Of course, that's true to some degree. But you know, I come from a society that is extremely unfree, you know, where a person like me could have never achieved the level of, you know, prosperity that I have and comfort and security, especially me as a woman, especially me as an independent woman stepping out on my own and, you know, having my own job and making my own way. This is not something I could have done, in, you know, the society that I was born in. So I don't take America for granted. I don't take the West for granted. It was not, you know, even our immigration process was, there were, my family came here, my parents came here, and I became an immigrant under my, you know, as a minor. I became a citizen as related to my father. I never took it for granted. He could have decided at any point that, you know, this isn't working out. We're going back to Pakistan. I would have no legal right to stay in the United States. And I would be back in that society. Or United States could have chosen not to accept us for any number of reasons, not to accept our citizenship for any number of reasons. And then I wouldn't have had it. And I wouldn't have. So I never once took it for granted. I grew up with this fear of something happening and our citizenship not being secured and I would have to go back to Pakistan. You know, it was so real to me all the time. It was real to me that this could be my reality. And then I would have to, you know, marry some guy and be dependent on him in so many different ways. And, you know, what would my life look like? So, you know, the way that I was raised, it was always clear to me that there's this other way and it's awful. and here I'm so privileged to have all these advantages just merely by being in this society. I have so many advantages. So that's always, you know, that's always in the back of my mind. It's always been in the back of my mind. It's been a part of my formation as a person. So when I see people just disparaging the United States in a very broad way, in a thoughtless kind of way, it's hard for me not to get angry, because in a way it's sort of an anti-immigrant sentiment, because, you know, it's almost like saying that I'm crazy because here I am coming to hell on earth. But why would my family have sacrificed everything to come into this society, right? I mean, are we crazy to have sacrificed so much, to have worked so hard to come here? Of course we're not crazy. We're gaining something, gaining a lot. So that's something that I'm always thinking about. And I remember, I don't know if you remember, there was that image of that kid who was drowned, a migrant child that drowned on his way to Europe a long time ago. There was when they were having a migrant crisis, and there was just like this it was just a horrifying photograph of this kid that had drowned. They were on boats to come to Europe, and they had drowned on the way, and there was just his lifeless body like on the ocean. And I remember, you know, all the liberals and leftists around me, won't say the word liberal, but progressives around me, rallying around migrants and rallying around, you know, this idea that we should let as many in as possible, help as many as possible. And of course we should, and we should also acknowledge that they are coming here for a reason. There is a reason they're sacrificing so much to get here, because there's something valuable here. There's something worth protecting here. And so what are those things, and how can you protect them?
Yeah. And I think it might be a shallow, I don't want to say the word reactionary, but I think it is a shallow take to say that they just want the resources here.
Yeah.
It's not just the wealth, it's the way of life as well. It's that which unlocks the wealth or generates the wealth that the West has.
It's one big, you know, parcel that includes, yes, material comforts, and those matter, because, you know, I mean, and again, it's one of those things where if you don't have them, you don't know what it's like, you know, what poverty really is, what not being able to afford the doctor, what not having paved roads, you know, reliable electricity, which they don't have in Pakistan, you know, like all that means to your life, and how devastating it can be to live without it. So, you know, I wouldn't even downplay the just being an economic migrant, because just to live in a society is to have a level of freedom, or to have a level of security and safety that wealth provides. You know, roads that are lit up at night, you know, social services that you can call on, a police force that exists and isn't, you know, I mean, we think we know corruption. We don't know corruption. There's police corruption that is in the third world that is unbelievable, where you really, really can't rely on them. They won't protect you. You know, and so even from that respect, I wouldn't even downplay that. But you're right, there are also so many other things that they're also looking for. Just for me, the ability to live as a woman and to be able to determine my own life, there's so many ways that the West grants me that freedom that, you know, places in the Muslim world just don't have. Mm-hmm.
And see, there's a kind of a, like a romantic problem in a way. It's not romantic to be a generation that's maintaining the structure that you have. I'm thinking probably, you know, Gen X and on, my generation, we grew up in America. We've benefited from a number of different ideas that kind of drove America, but then a lot of historical circumstances, World War II, last century, all that stuff. And it's hard to, you get to a sense where like, we're just at the end of time here, and you're really insulated from poverty. You're insulated from a lot of the realities because the system is kind of just driving itself. And you're just kind of called to maintain that system, to go get a job and work for the corporate structure or maintain liberal values. There's something much more romantic about seeing that as this oppressive system that you have to break and rebirth. Like there's this really, and that might be a product of just youthful hunger to be involved in something that powerful. And so the a version of the social justice mindset and critical social justice mindset is being propped up and propelled by this romantic desire to be a part of history, to be something that's turning the wheel in a very dramatic fashion. And you see that especially over the last year, but I've been watching it kind of pop up in smaller pieces here and there since 2014, 2015. It keeps on getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So the one of the questions is, how do you fight a narrative of that? Or how do you, maybe romanticism is not the right way of thinking it, but I think you kind of have to make liberalism sexy again. You have to make these kind of these values of free speech, even though it's harmful speech, like powerful in some way. You have to be persuasive. I don't know if that's something that speaks to you, but I see that as a problem.
That's very much, I mean, the way that I approach activism is to, you know, first understand humanity as it is, the tendencies that we do have pulling us in one direction or another. And I think one of the, it's very true that we have a drive to see ourselves as revolutionaries, especially as young people. And especially if we're bored, right? Especially if we generally do have a lot of comforts, then it's especially important to see ourselves in a specific way. And I don't want to, you know, I think you're right to be hesitant to call it romanticizing or not. I mean, let's not put a moral value on what is a human tendency, not just of, you know, privileged, you know, white kids in, you know, Virginia, but really anywhere, right? We all have this tendency. We get to a certain place, a certain level of comfort, and maybe we want to see more of excitement in our lives. But to some degree, we have to understand that. We have to see it coming and then harness it in a way that's not deleterious to the society around us. We fail to do that when it comes to wokeism, because I think certainly there's too many young people who have completely bought into this way of thinking that is deeply illiberal, deeply harmful, will certainly result in a society that is less free, less open. And then perhaps we'll have another, you know, reaction after that, where then it'll become cool to be young and to push back against it. Perhaps we're there now. You know, to the extent that we see more and more institutions become woke and adopt these. And I saw an ad recently for the CIA.
Oh yeah, the CIA.
It was super woke. And I mean, there's, you know, there's woke capitalism that I've talked about and, you know, derided publicly in the past. And then there's this, you know, like
woke government, CIA. The woke Fed. You're like,
right. So maybe we're going to get to a place in, you know, in the near future where it will become cool again to espouse liberal values in the face of this corporate wokeism and, you know, with all the squares and the suits adopting this kind of ideology, maybe it'll become cool again.
Well, you might have some insight into this angle. You've been an activist. You've been working as an activist and being, you know, trying to create political action and social change and providing like resources. You're working in the activist space. You're working in the NGO space or GNO, the
NGO. Yeah,
well, NGO space, and that a lot of the wokeness caught on there in that space very strongly, and it probably came from the colleges. I don't know, but what's the proper way to do activism? A lot of the stuff that I was critiquing was activism, but now activism's everywhere, or activism, some sort of weird strain of activism has activated everything to turn it woke. And I think woke has something like an attachment. There's all these values that it has, but then there's this activist kind of motivating structure. How do you do that right? Or can you reverse engineer that? Or how have you avoided or steered your company or your project through a culture that's
I think you're right to see that the NGO space, the nonprofit space, the foundations, charitable organizations, they tend to be more woke than non-woke, unless they're explicitly conservative. Like an explicitly conservative think tank can and will resist wokeism, but all other, nonprofits from where I stand, what I can see in this space, the woke takeover happened a while back. It's been kind of a complete victory, in a way that, we're just starting to see in corporations, in government. But this is already, it already happened in the nonprofit space. And I think that this is largely due to the kinds of, the kinds of people that populate the nonprofit space and, the activist world, which are related. They're not exactly the same, but they are related. Activists tend to be people who are working in nonprofits. Not always. Sometimes it's just an administrator type working in nonprofits. But those persons, they sort of coexist. I mean, they're similar ecosystems. They work together. And those spaces became very woke, very quickly, very, very quickly. And I think that happened because you have a strong, the kinds of people that are attracted to this space are people who might, one, what we just discussed earlier, have this tendency to, romanticize change and romanticize their place in the world, and want to be heroes in some sense, want to be the good guys fighting the bad guys and making
or even just better. To do good work.
To do good work. That's even maybe the way to phrase it was a negative way, and perhaps a demeaning way, but of course I don't mean to do it as I am an activist. But to see yourself as someone who's doing good work in addition to actually do good work, right? So you have that kind of personality. You have often a highly empathetic personality, someone who's there to care, who mm-hmm. does care and cares deeply, feels strongly, sees, injustice in the world and is angry that it's there, right? It has a very strong emotional response to seeing certain kinds of things, certain kinds of social ills, right? Mm-hmm. So you already have these kinds of people. I'll also add, there's an element of idealism that's present. And that's, you might even say necessary to be in the nonprofit space or to be an activist and to function well as an activist, to sort of, imagine this utopia and work hard to get there regardless of what stands in your way. And often what stands in your way is, a lot more than, anyone, more than most people realize. In my space, for example, one can just, if you stand outside of it, you think, okay, well, what you're facing is Islamist theocracy, you're facing terrorists, you're facing, murderous psychopaths who will just, within your own families will want to, hurt you for doing what you're doing. So one can say this is an uphill battle, but an idealist, the kind of person that's attracted to this kind of work, activist work, is somebody who might think that, we can do it, so there's a level of I think idealism there, and also this tendency to move forward despite what might seem like a daunting reality. So you have this personality that's in this space. Wokeism can plug in to that personality and just, it's like taking, it plugs into the back of your head and takes ownership of the body and the mind, and moves it to where it wants you to go. I've seen organization after organization dismantle their missions or rethink them, recategorize them in a way that now includes social justice alongside, what might have been a more strict mission, of like doing a particular thing, solving a particular issue, but now it's, you know, we're solving this, but also racial injustice, also,
long list of inequities to solve.
Right. Like there's so many, but right. It's just, they expand their scope, so wide. The net is so wide that in fact, many organizations I feel cannot effectively do, the thing that they were created to do. The ACLU, I think, is a great example of this. I don't want to discuss it at length, but I think if anyone wants to look into what the ACLU has been up to, they have, I think, abandoned their mission, which was a really important mission of defending civil liberties, to now that is, you know, defending dogma, defending woke dogma in what is a surprising and bizarre turn. Today's ACLU,
and they went all the way too.
They've lost the plot. And you know, this is an organization which now would not do what, you know, it had the courage to do many years ago, where it stood for the rights of, you know, Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois. And that, you know, that ACLU is not this ACLU. And if something like that were to happen again, this ACLU, at the very least, the national ACLU branch, would not stand for it. They would not do what they had the courage to do a long time ago. Yeah. So I think I've seen personally organization after organization flip in this way. And so you have a wide variety of progressive causes that are, it's worth fighting for, right? Women's rights organizations, even secular organizations specifically that are focused on, you know, separation of church and state, the ACLU with its civil liberties. I mean, these are all missions that are independently worth serving and actually require all your energy to focus on and to serve that. But there's this flattening of the discourse and the flattening of organizations where one sounds very much like the other. And, you know, everyone has sort of expanded their scope to all of social justice. And in effect have become not very good at doing the things that they were created to do. You know, they were founded to do. I've seen this in the secular space. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but it's really sad to see secular organizations, which I think have such an important mission to maintain separation of church and state, humanist organizations that have, you know, an important mission to spread and promote humanism, which is a beautiful way of looking at the world. And I think, you know, I call myself a humanist, and to see these organizations sort of abandon that in service of the social justice mission, I guess.
It seems like those organizations, they flatten that everything, and this is critical social justice does this to every single organization. And it's been honed in the nonprofit space and then in academia. There's like this whole pedigree, but it over and over again, it takes over like the goal and it makes this very diffuse goal about instituting a utopia. But because it can't do anything specific, I guess it kind of just creates a bunch of people that think all the same way and then go around and kind of bicker with each other. They all say the same thing. So the only thing it's producing is a certain kind of person, which is kind of a paper bag of a person, right? Because it's so restrained.
And they say all the same thing. It's sometimes I feel like I'm in, you know, a movie or, you know,
like Groundhog Day or something.
It's so bizarre. Day. You know, some scandal. It's always ridiculous. Somebody being smeared or mobbed. It's always on ridiculous terms. And then they offer the same apology, and bow in the way that you're supposed to. And to see it again and again, and to see them use the same language in a way that I think I don't think they understand what it is that they're saying. So when we use the word, you know, marginalized communities, what is it that we mean exactly? How does one become? What are the circumstances in which a community is deemed marginalized? Yes, you know, it's important to revisit the language that we're using and understand why we're using it, in order that it doesn't become meaningless jargon, empty jargon that people just repeat without really understanding what it is that they mean. Phrases like harm, I think, are extremely broadly used. And as somebody who works in a space where I've become very dark, haven't I?
Yeah, I was going to say, but I don't want to interrupt your flow. Do you have like a light in front of you somewhere or like above
I have a lamp. It's just that there's the sun has come out after the storm.
We did capture some lightning.
Let me see. I have a lamp.
There we go. Yeah, there we go.
Better than nothing?
Yeah, it gives you a little bit less flatness since we're talking about being a flat, well-rounded character.
It might just not be great for a while, but...
Well, you're not a professional podcaster like yours truly, so it's to be forgiven. Yeah.
I should have a space like this in my home, because this happens a lot, so I should learn from it. But yeah, right. Well, what were we talking about?
Well, this is a kind of a follow-up question to that. What made you immune to this, to plugging in, to getting that plug, that little Borg chip plugged into you? And I ask that, what qualities do you see make people inoculated to that Borg chip? And what qualities in organization, at the individual level and organization level, make it resistant to broadening that, I guess, effect, and then just creating a bunch of people that are then policing each other? Mm-hmm. And it seems like activists kind of take over it and they kind of start to dominate the discourse. I've seen it happen over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Like there's this contingent that comes up, dominates discourse, and then forces everybody into it. So I'm wondering if you've seen patterns of resistance that have worked, that have survived, or that you've implemented to keep your work on point with what you want to accomplish.
Right. So, I mean, in terms of, personally, what might, why I wouldn't say I'm immune. I would say I'm harder to convert, probably because I had the experience of leaving a faith, and it costing me a lot to do it. There's this loss of honor, of standing within your community. And my community, prior to me leaving the faith, I was a smart young woman, and my community recognized that, and they had high hopes for me as somebody who would represent Islam. And I remember not quite my imam, but like the equivalent to a Sunday school, but my the head teacher, I guess, of our school, had so many high hopes for me, and he was, ready to help me. He wanted to see me run for office, and he would always say this, read this again and again. He's like, you gotta run for office. You should be a senator. You should be, and we'll help you. And the community was ready to rally around me, but I was not there for them intellectually. Right. So I had this experience of by the choices that I made because of the things that I deeply believe, suddenly becoming an outcast, suddenly becoming, going from a person that was admired within a community and as an example for other, young women, to suddenly become stigmatized and be the person that you're not supposed to be. And to be the one that, to be the person that suddenly moms are afraid their daughters will become more like, right? So which is a big, it's a shift. And so I've experienced it before, and I've dealt with this before, so I can go through it again without as much pain and tears, I think, as somebody who's going through it the first time.
So you're not terribly worried about cancellation?
I'm not terribly. Yeah, I've been through the worst of it, and within my space, and I don't think that. There's something to be said about not wanting to have the same experience again and again. I mean, it's on the one hand, it inoculates you. On the other hand, it wears you out. You've already experienced this, and you don't want to be burned again and again and again. So maybe you recognize the patterns and fall in line quicker this time. So I think personally that has definitely played a role in my, but from an organization perspective, we're a young organization, so I don't want to toot our horn too quickly to say that we've resisted. I think that we have, and part of the reason that we have is that leadership has been very straight in terms of mission-oriented right from the beginning. Like, here's our mission. It's strict, but it's a very important mission. We're not going to expand it to everything and anything. And we're doing that because we believe that these values are so important, and somebody needs to focus and serve this and really nothing else. So we've resisted expanding our mission. And I think that that's something that, you know, the woke in general count on, that in order to have, you know, they'll say in order to have, you know, this, you also have to have racial justice. There can be no justice without racial justice, without, you know, sexual equality, without gender equality, whatever. But we've said, we resisted that very well by staying mission oriented. I think companies also that resist it well are companies that say, well, we're going to focus on our work. We're focusing on our mission. I think Coinbase did this recently, and then we're called all kinds of names afterwards for daring to be a company that
Lost a number, like a dozen or so employees or people that are working for them that might be all told a good thing, because if those people wanted to speak politics their whole job, then like, go ahead
and go. Addition by subtraction, in my opinion, because those sorts of people can really, really create a toxic work environment I think of this woke ideology as a parasite, and I treat it as a parasite. And I think you need to have courage in leadership, that they accept that they will be seen as villains by some people, and then that's okay. That's what leadership means, that not everyone will like what you're doing, and not everyone will think you're great, and a lot of people will call you a tyrant, and that's okay. And that's what you need to do, including being seen as not a great person by members of your own tribe. And you have to be willing to do that. And I think to some degree, the elite that fall to wokeism, the organization heads, are people who are unwilling to go there. They're unwilling to be, they want to be the good guy. They want to be seen as a good guy, and have all the nice profiles written about them, in major media outlets. And then they make themselves vulnerable to this kind of thing. So I think you need a lot of courage. You need the willingness to accept that people are going to think of you as a villain, and that's okay. And I think you need to be incredibly, like, I don't want to use the word intolerant, but, I think liberals in general have this tendency where we will talk it out. We will discuss this. We will give them the benefit of the doubt, and all of those are great things that we should do. But in a workspace, in an organization, there needs to be limits to that, you know, as well. And as an organization leader, you need to be willing to put your foot down and say, look, we're here to do a job, and this is distracting.
So you have no problem with people thinking of you as a hard ass. You actually take pride in that.
Not at all. And I hope that that's what they think when they apply to be, you know, my employee or, you know, to work with me in some way. I hope they know that that's what they're about to get, because it sort of culls the kind of people that come to me anyway. And that's, you know, in my opinion, that's a good thing. So from the perspective of what we saw with Coinbase, to me, that's addition by subtraction, definitely. And I think that the steps that they took were very smart in the long run.
Well, your work it requires a certain level of bravery. I mean, even if you yourself won't accept the mantle of being courageous and brave, or stunning and brave, even, what you're trying to do is empower people to be courageous in their own life and to take steps that require a lot. You require a lot of bravery, or you're contacting people who require a lot of bravery to step out and to deal with the issues that you're helping deal with. So you can't just be a softie at the top, or you can't model, I guess, cowardice. You can't model the negative behavior of the opposite of bravery and expect to actually get anything done.
I think, you know, we tend to underestimate the importance of having figures to look up to and to model ourselves towards. And in my own personal life, I try to, you know, have heroes in my life and to have people that I look up to and view them, of course, as human, you know, not expect perfection from them, but understand here are the things that make this person so interesting and worth following, you know, and worth listening to and worth being a student of. Recently, I posted you know, a tweet saying in support of Richard Dawkins, saying that, you know, he's a hero of mine. He's a teacher. And I've viewed him as a teacher for a very long time, and I'm going to continue to do that, even if, and of course we disagree on things, right? That's true of me and every hero, but that doesn't mean that they're not a hero. That doesn't mean that I'm not going to continue to follow them and to learn from them. So I think that to the extent that we can have heroes, we should, you know, choose them wisely, but, and be forgiving towards them, and be willing to learn from them. But there's this mood that is very anti-hero, right? That's tear down the heroes, tear down the, right? That's specifically in the Western context, so many of them happen to be old white men. And that's just because we're in the West, so they're going to be old white men that are our heroes. But the mood is, let's tear these people down, you know, cancel them. And I think that that's something so toxic. And I want to work against it. And to the extent that people can see me as a model, you know, the way to move forward has to be that I have to be willing to accept that some people will see me as like the anti-model, right? Some people will see me as exactly the person you don't want to be.
Hmm. What's something in your life that refreshes you, that sets you back up after dealing with all the heavy issues that you deal with? What's a source of renewal and maybe light redemption that you, or even pleasure, if that's what it takes?
That's a good question. In, you know, a very literal sense, there's, I enjoy, like, I'm a student of history, and I enjoy reading about, you know, societies, you know, long ago, you know, and reading sort of contemporaneous accounts. It's so interesting to see sort of the same things cropping up again and again, and it's comforting because it makes you think, okay, we can handle this. We've handled it before, and we can handle it again. And so that's a sense of comfort, and in a way that I can sort of, it helps me process my own emotions towards our current space. I also get a lot of messages. I leave some, you know, my DMs open. I can't read all of them, but I try to read as many as I can. But I leave these spaces open, and people will reach out to me and will say that I've de-radicalized them in one way or another. And it's awesome to see that there are people who are listening. They're not participating. They're just watching, and they're learning, and they've changed their views.
De-radicalization. That is something that I was going to do a series on, but I still need to, because it's a very important topic to get, because it's not just enough. It's way past time to make arguments. If we're just talking about like the collection of toxic behaviors that go under the banner of wokeness right now, it's too late to argue. And it's not an argument anyways. It's more of a narrative than an argument. It's more of a belief system than some sort of logical system. So it's not even enough necessarily to describe it. And if you want to describe it, you can spend all day describing it over and over and over again. What needs to happen is, when people are ready, that they have tools to get back out, that they have tools to rebuild, or to lead themselves to a fuller experience of being engaged with the world. And one of the critiques that I have of critical social justice is that it broadens the organization into inactivity almost, or ineffectualness, and it narrows the human being to ineffectualness too.
That's right.
So, you know, providing stepping stones, or just little places towards de-radicalization, or under the umbrella of de-radicalization, there's a lot of tools to be brought forth and thought about, and just kind of scattered around the room of society for people when they're ready to go on an adventure in a different direction.
Yeah, I think that was an interesting way that you put it there, that, you know, broadens mission, but it does, I think, force, you know, us as people to see ourselves as a collection of labels, in a way that is, it is dehumanizing, you know, to me, it feels wrong. It's not correct, in a very literal sense, in that I feel like I'm a bigger person, And I feel like I cannot be accurately described by a collection of labels, but I feel forced to put myself there. So I can say that I'm a woman of color. I'm an immigrant. I'm, you know, someone who grew up economically disadvantaged, whatever. Like there are all these ways of describing myself, but none of them feel right. Because there's actually hundreds of labels. You know, there's those that are the you know, certain facts that society chooses to consider important for one reason or another, and some that are very important. And then there's so many others that, you know, that describe me as well. You know, maybe you can say that I'm disagreeable as a personality, and I am. I'm at in the clinical sense, right? In the psychology sense.
Are you going to whip out your Ingram now too? Your INJT or whatever? I never know all the labels on that.
Yeah, I think I did that. I don't know which one I was, but I was one of the ones that was disagreeable. I always am. Anytime I do any of these, which is just fun, as a navel-gazing exercise. But, you know, I do feel limited by you know, the conception of me as a, you know, just this, like, as a woman of color only, right? So I try to stay away from that label, period. I don't ascribe that label to myself. I bring it up in conversations like this when it becomes important. It's bizarre to see people introduce themselves that way, you know, and say, as a blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And I often step back and think, why is it important to you to put that right, you know, right front and center in that way?
Do you mind, to wrap up, would you mind getting a little tribal and plug something from Pakistani culture or something from your origin, that, like a piece of art or an artist or something out there that people can go and experience the flavor of where Sarah Hader came from, or something that you even keep with you through your secular adventures?
That might be a little harder for me, because that's sort of my you know, earliest memories are of Pakistan, and because I was fully immersed, there was no plan to come to the United States. So all of that, what I remember in my early childhood was Pakistani. I guess the thing that really...
How old were you when you...
I came here when I was 8, 7, 8.
Okay. So you had...
So I spent most of my life here, right? But
eight is a long time to be. You weren't like 2 or 4. You have memories of...
I have memories, yeah. I have memories. And I have, you know, a lot of good memories. I guess the thing that I value a lot from, you know, Desi culture in general, the food is fantastic. I have my earliest memories are myself eating, you know, I ate mangoes and pomegranates, and then I came to America and there were apples and bananas, and I didn't think that they were as good. I remember thinking that I remember having a strawberry shake for the first time, and it looks very similar to what you have in Pakistan, which I guess people listening to this can try. It's a drink called Roo Abza. It's essence of rose, and it's rose flavor. It's like popular flavor. That's in very common in India and Pakistan.
Is that like a Slurpee or a slushy or some sort of iced?
It's like a syrup. And then you can make drinks out of it. You can mix it in a lot of different things. You can, you know, have vanilla ice cream and then pour it over. It's this bright red thing. But I remember having strawberry here, and I was expecting this rose, you know, flavor, and getting instead strawberry. And I remember how awful that felt and how much I hated it. That's something people can try.
Do they have that around still? Roo Abza?
Roo Abza. You can probably find it in any Indian, like Pakistani mart, like one of those ethnic marts.
A restaurant. It's speaking of food, is there and this will be my last question. Like, do you have any, like, your favorite food? I know this is a stupid thing. I'm just really interested in, like, your utmost dish.
My favorite dish is that is also a Pakistani dish. It's called nihari. It's my favorite dish. It's like a curry with beef traditionally, and it used to be, as are many good, like, deeply satisfying dishes, they're like dishes for poor people, right? Or used to be. This was one of those dishes that used to be for laborers, and it would cook all night in these little clay, pots, and then in the morning you would have it with breakfast. But now it's this extravagant thing that you have in weddings.
Oh, okay. But
it's deeply satisfying, very good. You have it with naan.
I haven't been to an Indian or Pakistani restaurant in a while, and you're bringing back delicious memories for me. Thank you for your afternoon, Sarah. This is a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations for reaching the end of the discussion. If you enjoyed it, do be sure to leave a review or a comment or a thumbs up or whatever you need to do to show that glorious algorithm that this is some good stuff. And do be sure to go and check that back catalog, as it is brimming full of fantastic conversations. Links to provide monetary support are down there in the description as well. Have a good night.